One of our guests from last week, I think she was on last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, Barbara Kay, the great National Post columnist. And boy, she writes great stuff. And she was talking about a particular issue, and that was dealing with parents from Toronto who were attempting to raise their latest child with his or her gender identity being hidden. Barbara Kay, we could have actually had Barbara Kay on for any number of articles, and one of the articles we could have had her on about was something she wrote May 18th about the notorious, in my description anyway, notorious Insight free shoot 'em up gallery in the heart of downtown Vancouver, where there's a special zone. Gee, we're talking about special zones tonight. We have this special no protest zone in Toronto for abortion. We got this special zone in Vancouver where you are allowed to freely use drugs, shoot up, and display the drugs, and nobody's going to take you to task. That's Insight. Well, we didn't have Barbara Kay talking about that, but that's certainly an issue that's very important. There's a reference to the Supreme Court of Canada on that, is there not, that they're pondering and maybe coming down with a decision with very shortly.
That is true, yes.
And obviously, there's lots of people talking about this with lots of different viewpoints, and one of those comes from the Alcohol Drug Education Service. And joining us tonight is the communications director of that organization, Jay Niver. Hello, Jay.
Hello. How are you, Terry?
Absolutely great. And I'm with Mark Hashek tonight as well.
Yeah, I got to meet Mark briefly the other day at the forum.
Yes. Hi, Jay. Good to see you again. Hear you again.
Good to see you.
That's right.
Good to see you guys on radio too.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. Now, actually, when Kerry Simpson was our normal guest host and sort of the executive producer of this show, was in touch with you, getting you on the show tonight. I had never heard of Alcohol Drug Education Service. I'm sorry about that. I guess there's so many issues and organizations out there. But first up, before talking about the...
Terry, let me interrupt you briefly for 1 second. That means I must not be doing my job as the communications director.
Don't mean to insult you. You've probably never heard of me, so that's fine.
Well, no, I hadn't heard of Roadkill until I got the call from Kerry.
Oh, that's great.
But I have to tell you, our agency, unlike a lot of nonprofits, has been in business now for 59 years.
Wow, fantastic.
Helping to keep kids drug-free, that's our motto.
Well, that's
the commercial, okay.
Good, no, that's what I wanted to find out about. So just tell us a little more about the agency. Where's the funding come from, and what sort of activities is it involved with before we talk about the conference that just took place?
I haven't been with the agency for 59 years, but what I know about it is that it actually grew out of the post-World War II situation. We incorporated in 1952, and there were still a lot of men who had served in the war and came home with drinking problems. And our agency had its birth out of churches and church groups whose women wanted their men to clean up their act.
Mm.
And so when we got started, we focused primarily on alcohol, but soon realized that the triumvirate of evil was alcohol, marijuana, and also tobacco. And in the 59 years since then, we've still focused on those particular substances as primarily the gateway drugs. And I know that some people, don't buy into that gateway concept. But what I say to them is that I never met anybody who went out and tried smack for the first time without trying something else beforehand. And I don't know anybody who does coke the first time they want to get high. And we still feel that if we can address those three substances with youth, and we are youth-oriented and preventive. We want to prevent problems before they arise because, as you know, it's always cheaper and easier to prevent a problem than it is to cure it later on. And in the 59 years, we've had a number of programs. We're primarily funded through various government sources, ministries. We just completed a major project for Health Canada. And we also have private donations and some foundations that fund us. And we concocted, I shouldn't say concocted, it doesn't sound good. We've created a curriculum that is used in schools across British Columbia. It's been in schools now for over 20 years. It's called Making Decisions, and it starts in grade 4 and goes all the way through grade 9. And that's what we feel we can do best, is to help fight the scourge of drug problems, and the way to do it is to help kids make healthy decisions in the beginning.
Are you we often hear this, I've heard this over the years, and talking about, and reporting on and talking with people about drug education, about the problem that can sometimes arise about exposing children to too much information too young, and in a way kind of triggering a curiosity about something, even when you're telling them 100 times, don't do it, this is bad for you, things like that, in some sort of way you are actually triggering the desire in them to experiment. How do you deal with that?
That's an argument that goes beyond just drug education.
Sex education as well.
Exactly.
So how do you deal with it? What's your response regarding the drug education
aspect?
Well,
the first thing I would say is we don't tell kids, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. I think I'm paraphrasing you. The research has proven for a long time now that telling a kid not to do something is about the quickest way to get he or she to do it.
I used it myself, that strategy, a few times.
What we prefer to do, and maybe it's a little bit of wishful thinking, is to provide information on the options and information on the drugs and information on things so that youth can make an informed decision. And the other thing that I have to say that we believe at Alcohol Drug Education Service is we don't spend a lot of time going around and telling youth or preparing materials to tell youth about specific drugs and what they do and what they don't do. Because as you know, the smorgasbord of drugs gets bigger with each passing year and sometimes each passing month. Now, that said, we have our own website, drugfacts.ca, and we try to make that information available. But what we're trying to do at ADES is to provide kids and parents and educators with some of the tools that can go beyond just identifying drugs and saying what this drug does or doesn't do. And as I was talking with Carrie early on, the two things we found that are most helpful, as opposed to just strict information, are to create family and school connectivity. And this goes beyond just drugs. Any young person who is connected in a positive way with his family and his parents and his siblings and is connected with his school is going to have a far better chance of making sound decisions, and not only about drugs. It's going to be the opposite.
Well, I've always said the number one parenting skill is actually not much of a skill. It's simply being there.
Absolutely.
Spending time with your kids, face-to-face interaction, on the weekends, whatever, after school. Being there. It's not brain surgery. It's very simple. There.
You're absolutely right, Terry. And when we do seminars, we have a workshop called Parents as Preventers, where we meet with parent groups. A lot of times the PACs bring us in. And we talk to parents about basically how to be good parents, but it's not rocket science. It's just be there. And I'm old enough to remember the old days when parents and their kids used to have meals together. And that's gone by the wayside. And something as simple as that really leaves a gap. And I hate to say it, but now one of the things we tell parents is if you can't have meals together, you need to communicate with your kids on Facebook. And you need to social network with them. And it's not to spy on them, but it's to use every way possible just to communicate and connect with your kids.
Okay, so let's. Good information there. And again, the website for anyone listening who wants to get that information is
www.ades.bc.ca.
Thank you very much for that. Now, what brings us together tonight, and actually brought you and Mark together over the weekend recently as well, was a conference. And this conference was the first regional conference of prevention and recovery providers.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Correct.
What was that? And that took place just last Wednesday, hosted by the Drug Prevention Network of Canada. So, Mark, why don't you take this away and ask if, I mean, you were there at the conference. What was this all about? Actually, I'm going to ask my co-host here to give me his...
I'd be happy to hear what Mark says. I know he's been writing about and commenting on this whole
so
topic.
So what brought you to that conference? And what was...
I was invited by the Drug Prevention Network of Canada's executive director, David Berner. He knows that I write about these issues often in Vancouver. The conference... primarily was brought together representatives of recovery homes, treatment centers, mainly abstinence-based. Now, that term, abstinence-based, it has different definitions depending on who you ask. I'd be interested to know what Jay feels, what are his thoughts about abstinence-based treatment. I know his is primarily a education-based.
So just very quickly,
sure.
This is the crucial issue when we're talking about insight, which embraces the harm reduction philosophy versus the people who say, no, we need to have this abstinence-based approach. That's the only thing that will really work long-term.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Sure. So Jay, what are your thoughts about abstinence-based treatment? And when I say abstinence-based, I believe abstinence means no drugs, no methadone, no Valium, no OxyContin, in a residential setting where you are looking to free yourself of all drugs. What's your take on abstinence-based treatment?
Well, I think you've probably defined it correctly, but let me throw a little monkey wrench there into that definition and maybe a little gotcha moment, is that there's all kinds of abstinence-based programs that are, you know, take place here and throughout BC in the country. And you go in there, and there'll be a place where everybody's smoking cigarettes. And you say, well, Niver, why are you getting off on that? Well, I'll tell you what, a big portion of our emphasis for 59 years is to have people prevent tobacco abuse. And if you're really going to talk about abstinence, why do people come in, and they're working to kick one or two or three bad substance abuse habits, but then there's no problem with them lighting up? And they're smoking like chimneys.
Okay,
and we know that statistically, tobacco is far more likely to catch up with you and cause serious harm than most of these other drugs.
That's an interesting point, but tobacco is not ruining the downtown east side at an alarming rate. What is your...
As, by the way, and I, you know, I agree with you there, Mark, in terms of... We're really talking about two different things here. I mean, alcohol abuse and the drug abuse on one side, but tobacco, I think, is an entirely different thing. Yes, there are adverse health consequences, but not the giant societal consequences, and not the and it doesn't change the behavior to the way that that alcohol addiction and drug addiction.
No,
does.
Nobody's sticking up a store to get a pack of smokes.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and also just what it does to you in your personal relations. You know, you don't see marriages breaking up and children being abused over tobacco addiction. So, I don't agree with you in terms of trying to stir that into the pot here. I think we are interested in the issue of where you stand on harm reduction versus abstinence when it comes to the hard drugs and alcohol.
I'll be happy to tell you that. Alcohol Drug Education Service is primarily focused on prevention. Okay, we're trying to hit youth before they get involved in any of these bad addictions that are going to cause them real harm or the potential for harm down the line. And I told David Berner this. I said, I'm absolutely in lockstep with you when it comes to prevention. And they call themselves the Drug Prevention Network of Canada. Now, by the same token, as I think Mark will agree, and especially after sitting through their conference, they are very much in favor of the abstinence-based approach, and to the point that they're almost against harm reduction.
Well, I don't think almost. I think I think a lot of that crowd was adamantly anti-harm reduction.
Okay, I agree with you. But we sat in the meeting where they backpedaled to say that, for the record, they're not against it. But you're right. Mm-hmm. They're very much against harm reduction. And here's where I come from on this, and this is my personal opinion.
Sure.
I hope it reflects my board and the people I work with at ADES, is that if we find something that helps people, we're not going to be against it. And if we see abstinence-based programs that are helping for people who have addiction problems, and that helps, absolutely, go for it. If we see harm reduction that is helping to save a few lives, we're not going to oppose that either. And I have to tell you that, having worked with both sides and kind of interfacing with the harm reduction folks on one side and the abstinence folks on the other, there's a real vitriol between them, and there's a huge gap. It almost reminds me of the gap between the pro-lifers and the pro-choicers. They're so extreme on both sides that it doesn't seem like they can talk to one another. And I think that's harmful. And maybe I'm taking an easy way out, because we're dealing with youth and prevention at ADES. So I'm not maybe forced to make a decision one way or the other. Now, my problem with Insight, as I mentioned at the conference, is not so much the idea of giving a junkie, well, they don't give them drugs. They let them use their own drugs, okay, supervised injection site. I don't agree with that personally, but the bigger problem I have with it is the cost. And I got involved in this debate about a year ago when the Vancouver Sun wrote a column defending Insight and singing its praises. And at that time, about a year ago, Insight was spending about $540 per client, okay? I can take $2 per student, a little less than $2 per student, and give them ministry-approved and recommended curriculum to help them prevent problems that are going to end up having them go to a place like Insight later on. I did my figures. For about $600,000 a year, we could put our ministry-approved program, and I don't care if it's mine, let's use somebody else's. You can put stuff in school classrooms that'll help kids get the materials and the insight, pardon the pun, the knowledge to make smart decisions for less than $600,000 a year. And meanwhile, Insight's budget, I think, is something like almost $3 million a year.
Can
so,
you,
so is that
on
smart
that point,
spending?
On the education point and spending money and the education, is there any way to measure how effective that would be, or how effective it has been? Have any studies been done where you've gone into a district and presented these programs from grade 4 to grade 12, or whatever it was you said, and then compared that district to another district and seeing what the impact has been?
There's the problem, Terry. It's real difficult to measure, because if I take making decisions into a school district and give it to these classrooms, how do I know whether or not what they've learned in class is going to help them stay off drugs? The way you're going to know is to measure in a longitudinal study, and that's going to take you going back after a year, after two, after three. And then the problem with drug education or any education is that there's so many factors involved. What happens in the classroom may be completely negated because they've come from a broken family. They have parents that aren't at home. Or maybe that they're influenced by the media or any of a dozen other factors. So it's difficult, and it's difficult for funding.
Yeah.
If I'm giving out lunches at a soup kitchen, people can see how many eat and what the effect is. If I'm providing housing for the homeless, people can count and see the result. But if we're trying to educate kids and society in general about drugs, it's tough. How do you measure it? And in fact, if you were to have a long-term study to see what the impacts were, you'd pay far more for the study than you would for the materials in the beginning.
And for it to be really effective and to show results, it would take years and years and years. And I think you put your finger on it, Jay. It's very difficult, and anything to do with addictions recovery or drug prevention, to come up with solid figures. Recovery homes will produce their own figures, and their versions of success vary on who you ask. When you throw harm reduction into the equation, where drug users continue using drugs as a form of treatment, that further muddies the waters about what makes a successful recovery. So it's very difficult to have solid figures, and that is why Insight is winning the media battle, because Insight is basically a study. That's what it is. You have researchers constantly employed to shoot out these reports and to counter them, to really counter an Insight research study. You would have to have access to the same number of participants that they do. You would have to get some Insight-friendly organizations to help you out with shepherding addicts into your study. And then you would need the millions of dollars and the countless man hours to conduct that study. And there simply hasn't been a counter study to the pro-Insight study.
Well, speaking of how difficult the study is, it's something Barbara Kay, my friend, the National Post columnist, wrote about a couple of weeks ago as well. She said, yes, it's true, as Insight says, that nobody ever died of an overdose at Insight, and that's a key argument that Insight supporters make. That's true, but so what, she writes. No depressed people would ever die from stepping off the Golden Gate Bridge if there were a safety net below it, but the net would do nothing to solve the depression of those jumping into the net, or help the many thousands of others who continue to jump from other high places in plain sight of the net, which sort of is a great parallel to look at what Insight is all about. But Jay, you've told us that you don't really want to get into the harm reduction versus abstinence debate per se, that you see some good in both. Do you really? I have a feeling, though, that this is a big debate, and then everybody involved in it's going to have to eventually take sides somewhere. Do you really believe that the sort of the short-term statistical blips that we see in favor of Insight, without actually dealing with the big, deeper problems, is enough to justify the funding for Insight? And maybe it's not your position to talk about it either personally.
Well, no, I told you I have a real problem with the funding for it, because it's all out of kilter. I want to see, and this is one.
So are you, is you and your group, is it your group, are you saying withdraw that funding, just shut her down and put it into education and put it into treatment? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't pass judgment on Insight per se in that regard. Here's what I would say, and I think it's one of the points that David Berner came up with after we had that meeting, Mark, and that was everybody agrees there needs to be a fairer, more balanced distribution of monies for addictions and prevention. And the way to make it fairer is to give some to the abstinence programs as well. And the way to make it fair is to take some away from harm reduction and give it to prevention. Now, when I say take some away, that's because I'm assuming there's a limited amount of money. The pie is only so big. And that's what I resent about it. I resent the fact that big chunks of the pie go to a certain approach that happens to be in vogue because of whatever prevailing winds, you know, from Victoria
Ottawa. And we're seeing that. I've been following the case in Coquitlam, where I live, of a proposed permanent homeless shelter. And the it is operating under this no barriers rubric, if that's the right way of philosophy, saying, well, we're to help get you guys off the street. Well, it's not the streets. They live in riverbanks and in forests where I live, in tents and things like that. To help get you guys into a permanent home and or this shelter, and to get you set up for treatment or counseling, whatever, we're going to have no barriers. You can come in and use the drugs. You can go out on the street and buy and sell drugs if you want. You can do that. And we're not going to stop you. We're not going to test you. We're not going to check up on you. We're not going to report you to the police, things like that. So this is causing some understandable consternation among the residents who live nearby. So this harm reduction versus abstinence issue plays out in more than just a specific drug treatment or not treatment. It plays out even in issues like this where we're talking about homelessness and the philosophy of shelter. And this apparently is sort of an edict that comes down from the provincial government. So I brought this up because I was thinking, well, if you're looking for more even distribution of money, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the provincial government is now definitely favoring the harm reduction model, and not just in drugs, but also in the homelessness.
Well, that sure seems to be the way that it's perceived by most of us in the business. And whatever works within reason. And the other thing, I think you mentioned this to Mark, is that there are degrees of what is harm reduction and how do you measure it. Now, I brought up something briefly at the meeting last week. We didn't have a chance to get into it. And I said that I think insight is too easy a target because it's too extreme for many sound-thinking people. It's too expensive. And they brag about the lives that they've supposedly saved, but you never hear them bragging about the people that they got off drugs. For my money, that's what I'd like to hear. I'd like to say, well, they saved 16 lives or 42 lives, but they also helped X number of addicts get off their habit. That would be what I'd want to hear.
Well,
but
well, that's regard, not their mandate, though.
But Mark, isn't there some sort of a report that I remember reading about a numbers of people who actually went into treatment through Insight, though?
Yeah, the different percentages have come out. It's increased. But the Insight does not claim to be a recovery or treatment center.
It's, no, but don't they have a... They've got something...
They have on-site upstairs, yes.
Yeah.
But it's
so Insight and on-site? No.
Insight and... On-site's on top of Insight.
Is that actual organization, or is that just...
Well, that's the name of the treatment
on-site,
facility.
On-site is on top of Insight.
It is.
Okay.
It is.
Got it. All right.
Okay.
And again, you run into the great difficulty of tracking the success rates of recovery. In the downtown east side, it's virtually impossible due to the transient nature of the population, the desire for many addicts to want to maintain anonymity. You just can't come up with reliable figures in that way. That's why I've proposed, and others have in the city of Vancouver, that there needs to be, if we are going to make harm reduction the guiding principle of recovery and treatment in Vancouver, there needs to be an inquiry bringing in law enforcement, the addictions recovery community, First Nations peoples, everybody come to the table. Come up, listen, if you're going to spend money on something like that to figure out exactly what the results are, as good as we can, and then go from there. But what has happened is we've created piecemeal policy in a very undemocratic way, I might add. And, from my perspective and from the perspective of all the people I talk to in the downtown east side that I'm familiar with, I have friends in the neighborhood, I know police in the neighborhood, things aren't getting any better. So we're going to reach a point here where something's got to give.
I wouldn't disagree with anything you've said. My biggest problem is take some of that money and put it towards some other resources and some other ways.
Mm-hmm. What do you guys feel? I ask both of you about this, about mandatory treatment. Apparently in Sweden, they've had remarkable success with a program of compulsory drug treatment for addicts. As a result, Sweden's rates for crime, disease, medical and social problems stemming from drug addiction are lower than other European countries. Jay, mandatory treatment, compulsory treatment for drug addicts. What do you think?
I tell you, that's a tough one, and I'm not an expert on what they're doing in Sweden. I surely wouldn't oppose the concept, and there's something a little bit similar if you follow down in the States. It's not quite mandatory treatment, but the Florida governor just signed a law that will require welfare recipients in Florida to pass drug tests in order to get their benefits.
Oh, that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, that's a little bit similar there.
You know what? There'd be a charter challenge up here as soon as you said brought it.
Before you could say boo. But it's interesting.
Before you could say insight saves lives.
It's interesting you bring up Europe, Terry, because they do put more money, as Jay, I'm sure, is aware, into tracking addictions recovery, into drug treatment. And 20 major European cities who have experimented with supervised injection have signed a declaration opposing it, because they found in their studies that not only did it not help the people it was supposed to help, but it was hurting the neighborhoods.
You know what? I seem to remember in the early days of the discussion over Insight that there were all these examples out of Europe where it was sort of working.
No, they cited examples because that's where the Insight model comes from. But the Europeans have wised up and signed off on it. Now, that's not to say that there still aren't supervised injection sites in Europe.
Right, but there are. It was European cities such as Berlin, Stockholm, London, and Oslo signed the declaration. These aren't just little, you know, little burbs, villages. These are pretty major places with a lot of experience.
Yeah, and you mentioned mandatory treatment,
yes.
Terry.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
Well, we talked about this last time I was on the show. There's nothing close to mandatory treatment in British Columbia. In fact, the methadone maintenance program, which is the most ubiquitous harm reduction program we have and the most damaging, I might add. I agree with Jay that Insight can be a distraction because it distracts you away from the absolute black scourge that is the methadone program in the downtown east side. You have thousands of people addicted to this just brutal substance that robs them of their destinies. They're like zombies for decades. There's not only is there no mandatory treatment, there's no treatment at all attached to the methadone program. As soon as you get a prescription from a doctor, you are free to go. Okay. You can go ahead and do whatever you want. To me, it's a crime. It's the greatest example of the bigotry of low expectations. You are telling someone that, yes, you're an addict, you're going to remain an addict, you're going to stay in the downtown east side. You may not be breaking down windows or holding up liquor stores because you're so whacked out on methadone, but we like where you are.
Yeah. And Mark, it's all done under the guise of tolerance, and that's supposed to be a humanitarian thing. Because we're tolerant of everybody and everything here in this West Coast mindset. And you can maybe tell that my tongue is a little bit in my cheek there, but this is a problem, I think. And tolerance basically is good, but I wish some of the harm reduction people would be tolerant of the abstinence-based people and vice versa. And I have to tell you something. You talk about mandatory treatment for people with addictions problems. We can't even get mandatory enforcement of the drug laws here.
Yeah, very good
drug laws.
I have to tell you,
drug laws?
I got a teenage son who lives down in the States, and a couple or 3 years ago when I was going to move to Vancouver, you know what the first thing he said? And he's not Einstein. He doesn't know a lot about geography or anything. He said, Vancouver? Oh, isn't that the place where you can go smoke dope anytime?
Well, you know what? In 1959, when I was 8 years old, our family moved here to the Vancouver area from Winnipeg, and my mother asked all of my brothers and me to take a pledge not to indulge in the drug culture of Vancouver. And I remember that in 1959, I was warned against it as a little boy.
Boy, it goes back that far.
Yes, it does. Listen, we just got an email from I don't know the name either, Helen or Chris, or maybe it's Helen, Chris, or Chris, said, talking about the funding aspect. And says, how about providing funding for the single largest preventer of addiction, not injection sites, not prevention education, but parents? She says, you're right, Terry. The research, $25 million U.S. longitudinal ad health study of 90,000 adolescents, that feeling of closeness to parents was the top protective factor in adolescent health issues, including drug use. So thank you for that insight, Chris or Helen. Do appreciate it. This underscores. I don't think any of us here disagree with that. Mark, you were talking about the the essentially the legalized addiction, the methadone treatment, treatment. It's essentially addiction as well, and it's addiction. It's enablement of a destructive habit, right?
Well, all the folks that I talk to tell me that it's more addictive than heroin. It's tougher to get off methadone than it is to get off heroin.
Right. People don't die short-term of overdoses, but this does it kill them? Do they have a shorter lifespan because of methadone?
That I'm not qualified to comment on, but I do know that it kills... It basically extinguishes any spark they have in their life.
Yeah.
If you've ever encountered anybody who is receiving a high dose, a daily dose, I might add, of methadone, which is the case for the majority of people in the downtown east side,
right.
You notice it. And they usually, because the opiate won't work, the methadone blocks a high from heroin, they usually, because they're so depressed and down from the methadone, they are using other drugs, mainly crack cocaine. The crack cocaine epidemic in the downtown east side is owed in part to the methadone scourge.
Troubling stuff. Were any conclusions, did any conclusions, Jay, emerge from the conference that you attended that you could share with our listeners?
I'm looking here at the report that David Berner prepared.
Yes.
And it says effective prevention work is most often about making choices and decisions less than discussions about drugs. And that gets back to the underlying things that we've been talking about, communications and family situations.
Want to interrupt you right there, Jay, for one second. It's true that a lot of, especially in the early grades in schools, that a lot of the prevention work, you don't even mention, you kind of alluded to this at the top of the segment, that they don't even mention drugs. Is that right? It's more of a relational thing.
Well, absolutely. Our curriculum starts in grade 4, and believe it or not, we've had requests to do programs for grade 1 students. And in grade 4, we've got a little story booklet about a friendly alien who arrives from a planet where there are no drugs. And his name is Zorga, and he wants to talk to the kids about what drugs are. And so at the grade 4 level, you're talking about you take aspirin to feel better if you've got a headache, and maybe mom and dad drink coffee, but that's caffeine, and maybe you see dad with a beer sometime. And you start out talking about basic things about how medicines and drugs can help or hinder us in life. And then as you progress through the grades, of course, it gets more and more developed in specifics. But always underlying is the thought of communication and interaction with your parents and why you take drugs. I've seen a very good program that's done in the schools where instead of talking about drugs, you talk about emotions. And you go through the whole panoply of different emotions and how you feel why. And then how do you react when you feel that? Do you take a drug? Do you drink too much? Do you lash out at people? And by understanding your emotions and getting a better concept of oneself, it helps you look at the larger picture of why we make these decisions to abuse our bodies and our minds.
Mm-hmm. Now that's important stuff. And maybe it's outside the reach of an underfunded educational program. I mean, we're dealing with large issues with family formation, with childhood parenting, maybe a drug epidemic is just a manifestation of that. Some people from different political perspectives would say that it's a manifestation of inequality between social classes or sexism or archaic laws or something like that. Everybody's got theories on this. I think it sounds like, Jay, you're on the right track when you're talking about relationships and emotions and things like that. That certainly can't hurt, and Lord knows that we need help. So to protect our most vulnerable citizens, our children. Does the Alcohol Drug Education Service as an institution or you personally have any thoughts about decriminalization or legalization as a way of dealing with some of these problems?
I can only speak for myself in that regard. We do not take a position on that, but we try to keep kids away from marijuana and alcohol and tobacco and ecstasy and all those other things. And I think as a consequence of that, common sense would tell you that we sure wouldn't be out there encouraging the government to make it easier to come by.
Well, we talked half an hour ago about the fact that people aren't holding up grocery stores to get money to buy cigarettes. One of the reasons for that might be that cigarettes are entirely legal, ever more circumcised. Is that the right word?
No. I don't think
no,
so.
No, I don't think so. Not circumscribed. My goodness. Thank you very much.
How did that get in there?
Well, circumscribed cigarettes are. But they're illegal, and there's very little black market for them, except when they get too expensive. Mm-hmm. There's certainly the argument that if marijuana were legalized, that it could be, and other drugs, actually some people say legalize all the drugs so they can better control, better quality control, and then we can use the money that the government can use the money that they raise through the sale of those drugs to deal with the problems. So anyway, that's a thought there anyway. It's not where I'm at, but I do hear persuasive arguments, very passionate arguments.
Well, it's not a complete parallel, but California has as good a financial reason as any governmental entity to make pot legal, tax it, and profit from it. And the electorate declined to do so last November.
That's a good point. Jay, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Communications Director of Alcohol Drug Education Service. Do appreciate it. We have to wrap up the show in just a few minutes, and continued good luck and keep up the good work.
Well, Terry and Mark, I appreciate the chance for me to participate with you, and I applaud you guys for dealing with these touchy topics.
Okay, thank you, and thanks for
be done.
Thanks for spending the time.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks.
Bye bye. Good night.
Bye bye.
So it's been a rather quick, fast moving 2 hours, don't you think?
That was great. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Good guests, lots of interesting topics.
And you know what? During the course of a normal show, I have a therapy. Therapy moment or so,
okay.
And I've actually been, I didn't really have a great need because our show was so rich with subjects that I'm passionate about.
Right.
But there was still one issue out there that we didn't touch on that probably sparked the greatest sense of my need for therapy that I felt in several weeks.
Do tell.
And that was the young woman who, during the throne speech in the House of Commons, a page, Bridget DePape Marcel held up a sign that said, "Stop Harper." Mm-hmm. I was shocked and appalled. I really was. Mm-hmm. Now, she's a hero in some, from the left wing, mm-hmm. thinks she's great. She's been all sorts of job offers from unions and things like that. And I think what she did was absolutely abominable. Atrocious, and I hope those are the right words too. Mm-hmm. I feel that it is so disrespectful. There are forums, proper forums. Now, if she one of the reasons apparently she wants to stop Harper is because she feels that the conservative government is anti-democratic.
Mm-hmm.
So, does she really think that it's a proper expression of free speech and democracy to do what she did to invalidate to go against the pledge that she took? I mean, she swore that to do her job properly and all this sort of stuff. Of course, she was fired right away, but she got her moment in the limelight. And I'm afraid that we're going to be seeing more and more of her, and maybe more and more of this sort of action as the conservative majority government goes about what it was duly elected to do. I don't know. What are your thoughts about what's coming in the next, about the left and the way the left responds to the right as opposed to the right's political protest against the left? To me, the left always seems to be more violent, more self-righteous, more prone to break the law, those sorts of things. Anyway.
Well, firstly, on the issue with the page in the comments, you have to wonder exactly what she meant by "Stop Harper." Anytime I see a stunt like that, I immediately think it would be really nice if that young person educated themselves on what democracy really is and how men, Canadian men, fought and died for our democracy. Yes. And the values that have been passed down from the English Bill of Rights across the pond.
Yes.
America, Canada. If she just had a little sense of history.
Well, she's got a sense of current events because she issued a press release. This country needs a Canadian version of an Arab Spring,
right.
A flowering of popular movements that demonstrate that real power to change things lies not with Prime Minister Stephen Harper, but in the hands of the people when we act together in our streets, neighborhoods, and workplaces. What about the ballot box?
Listen.
Democracy is the ballot box. You had your chance, Canada. And she's saying, not good enough. We have to act again in the streets, neighborhood, and workplaces. She's calling for an uprising against democracy.
Well, I would like her to go over to some of the Arab countries that are experiencing the Arab Spring and try to walk around in an outfit. I saw her on the news the other day. She might not be so enthused about the Arab Spring after the treatment.
I would like to send her to experience a few Arab Springs in person, and after that, a few Canadian winters up north, maybe.
But on your larger point, Terry, yeah, about the vitriol between the right and left, listen, there's vitriol on both sides of the extremes, but there is no doubt, and believe me, I can speak from experience, that the hate that is spewed from the left attacks your ability to speak. They don't want debate. And I'm not painting all left-wing people in with that brush. But the media-savvy ones, they want to stifle debate. They want to end speech. You see it on campuses around Canada and the United States. When someone, perhaps a conservative, comes to a campus to speak, they're shouted down. There's the shining face of inclusiveness and democracy on campus when they're drowning people out and throwing rotten tomatoes.
Right.
You don't get that from the far right. Listen, there are kooks on the far right, too, but they're usually respecting your right to speak. They're going to come after you about your position on an issue. But fundamentally, there's something wrong when you don't want to engage in debate, or you want to stop Harper or stop democracy, oppose his policies. Go out and be an activist. That's what democracy is all about.
Get involved.
It's just so nonsensical to go into Parliament.
You should have run for the NDP. You probably could have been elected in Quebec. Anyway, we've come to the end of our show. 9:30 here. 2 hours of wonderful, informative, interesting news. And thank you very much. Ron Gray has sent us a note saying Betty Krawcheck was the tree-hugging grandma. Thank you, Ron.
You knew that, though.
And I did know that after I wrote it down. But anyway, thank you very much. And Mark, it's been a real pleasure. Welcome aboard again. And
thanks,
been great for a show. Hope to see a lot more of you in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah, I hope so.
That's it for tonight's version of Roadkill Radio. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to Roadkill Radio. Join us again next week for another trip down the superhighway of information, fact, and truth.